exasperation mixed with an even stronger love. The love was helpless. The exasperation came from a feeling that she was deliberately being excluded. With the two of them around, she sometimes felt like an outsider, a bit player who had accidentally wandered back on stage while the main action was taking place. Well, they wouldn't be able to exclude her this winter, her two exasperating males. Quarters were going to be a little too close for that. She suddenly realized she was feeling jealous of the closeness between her husband and her son, and felt ashamed. That was too close to the way her own mother might have felt, too close for comfort. The lobby was now empty, except for Ullman and the head desk clerk. They were at the register cashing up. A couple of maids who had changed to warm slacks and sweaters, standing by the front door and looking out with their luggage pooled around them. And Watson, the maintenance man. He caught her looking at him and gave her a wink, a decidedly lecherous one. She looked away hurriedly. Jack was over by the window just outside the restaurant, studying the view. He looked rapt and dreamy. The cash register apparently checked out, because now Ullman ran it shut with an authoritative snap. He initialed the tape and put it in a small zipper case. Wendy silently applauded the head clerk, who looked greatly relieved. Ullman looked like the type of man who might take any shortage out of the head clerk's hide without ever spilling a drop of blood. Wendy didn't much care for Ullman or his officious, ostentatiously bustling manner. He was like every boss she'd ever had, male or female. He would be saccharine sweet with the guests, a petty tyrant when he was backstage with the help. But now school was out, and the head clerk's pleasure was written large on his face. It was out for everyone but she and Jack and Danny, anyway. "Mr. Torrance," Ullman called peremptorily, "would you come over here, please?" Jack walked over, nodding to Wendy and Danny that they were to come too. The clerk, who had gone into the back, now came out again wearing an overcoat. "Have a pleasant winter, Mr. Ullman."
"I doubt it," Ullman said distantly.
"May 12th, Braddock. Not a day earlier, not a day later."
"Yes, sir." Braddock walked around the desk, his face sober and dignified, as befitted his position. But when his back was entirely to Ullman, he grinned like a schoolboy. He spoke briefly to the two girls still waiting by the door for their ride, and he was followed out by a brief burst of stifled laughter. Now Wendy began to notice the silence of the place. It had fallen over the hotel like a heavy blanket, muffling everything but the faint pulse of the afternoon wind outside. From where she stood, she could look through the inner office, now neat to the point of sterility, with its two bare desks and two sets of gray filing cabinets. Beyond that, she could see Halloran's spotless kitchen, the big port-holed double doors propped open by rubber wedges.
"I thought I would take a few extra minutes and show you through the hotel," Ullman said.
And Wendy reflected that you could always hear that capital H in Ullman's voice. You were supposed to hear it.
"I'm sure your husband will get to know the ins and outs of the Overlook quite well, Mrs. Torrance, but you and your son will doubtless keep more to the lobby level in the first floor, where your quarters are."
"Doubtless," Wendy murmured demurely, and Jack shot her a private glance.
"It's a beautiful place," Ullman said expansively. "I rather enjoy showing it off."
"I'll bet you do," Wendy thought.
"Let's go up to third and work our way down," Ullman said.
He sounded positively enthused.
"If we're keeping you," Jack began.
"Not at all," Ullman said. "The shop is shut. Tout fini, for this season at least. And I plan to overnight in Boulder, at the Boulderado, of course. Only decent hotel this side of Denver, except for the Overlook itself, of course. This way."
They stepped into the elevator together. It was ornately scrolled in copper and brass, but it settled appreciably before Ullman pulled the gate across. Danny stirred a little uneasily, and Ullman smiled down at him. Danny tried to smile back without notable success.
"Don't you worry, little man," Ullman said. "Safe as houses."
"So was the Titanic," Jack said, looking up at the cut-glass globe in the center of the elevator ceiling. Wendy bit the inside of her cheek to keep the smile away. Ullman was not amused. He slid the inner gate across with a rattle and a bang.
"The Titanic made only one voyage, Mr. Torrance. This elevator has made thousands of them since it was installed in 1926.
"That's reassuring," Jack said. He ruffled Danny's hair.
"The plane ain't gonna crash, Doc."
Ullman threw the lever over, and for a moment there was nothing but a shuddering beneath their feet and the tortured whine of the motor below them. Wendy had a vision of the four of them being trapped between floors like flies in a bottle and found in the spring,
with little bits and pieces gone, like the Donner Party. Stop it. The elevator began to rise, with some vibration and clashing and banging from below at first. Then the ride smoothed out. At the third floor, Ullman brought them to a bumpy stop, retracted the gate, and opened the door. The elevator car was still 6 inches below floor level. Danny gazed at the difference in height between the third floor hall and the elevator floor, as if he had just sensed the universe was not as sane as he had been told. Ullman cleared his throat and raised the car a little, brought it to a stop with a jerk, still 2 inches low, and they all climbed out. With their weight gone, the car rebounded almost to floor level, something Wendy did not find reassuring at all. Safe as houses are not, she resolved to take the stairs when she had to go up or down in this place, and under no conditions would she allow the three of them to get into the rickety thing together. "What are you looking at, Doc?" Jack inquired humorously. "See any spots there?" "Of course not," Ullman said, nettled. "All the rugs were shampooed just 2 days ago." Wendy glanced down at the hall runner herself. Pretty, but definitely not anything she would choose for her own home, if the day ever came when she had one. Deep blue pile, it was entwined with what seemed to be a surrealistic jungle scene full of ropes and vines and trees filled with exotic birds. It was hard to tell just what sort of birds because all the interweaving was done in unshaded black, giving only silhouettes. "Do you like the rug?" Wendy asked Danny. "Yes, Mom," he said colorlessly. They walked down the hall, which was comfortably wide. The wallpaper was silk, a lighter blue to go against the rug. Electric flambeaux stood at 10-foot intervals at a height of about 7 feet. Fashioned to look like London gas lamps, the bulbs were masked behind cloudy, cream-hued glass that was bound with crisscrossing iron strips. "I like those very much," she said. Ullman nodded, pleased. "Mr. Derwent had those installed throughout the hotel after the war. Number 2, I mean. In fact, most, although not all, of the third-floor decorating scheme was his idea. This is 300, the presidential suite." He twisted his key in the lock of the mahogany double doors and swung them wide. The sitting room's wide western exposure made them all gasp, which had probably been Ullman's intention. He smiled. "Quite a view, isn't it?"
"It sure is," Jack said.
The window ran nearly the length of the sitting room, and beyond it the sun was poised directly between two saw-toothed peaks, casting golden light across the rock faces and the sugared snow on the high tips. The clouds around and behind this picture postcard view were also tinted gold, and a sunbeam glinted duskily down into the darkly pooled firs below the timberline. Jack and Wendy were so absorbed in the view that they didn't look down at Danny, who was staring not out the window but at the red and white striped silk wallpaper to the left, where a door opened into an interior bedroom. And his gasp, which had been mingled with theirs, had nothing to do with beauty. Great splashes of dried blood, flecked with tiny bits of grayish-white tissue, clotted the wallpaper. It made Danny feel sick. It was like a crazy picture drawn in blood, a surrealistic etching of a man's face drawn back in terror and pain, the mouth yawning, and half the head pulverized. "So if you should see something, just look the other way, and when you look back, it'll be gone. Are you digging me?" He deliberately looked out the window, being careful to show no expression on his face, and when his mommy's hand closed over his own, he took it, being careful not to squeeze it or give her a signal of any kind. The manager was saying something to his daddy about making sure to shutter that big window so a strong wind wouldn't blow it in. Jack was nodding. Danny looked cautiously back at the wall. The big dried bloodstain was gone. Those little gray-white flecks that had been scattered all through it, they were gone too. Then Ullman was leading them out. Mommy asked him if he thought the mountains were pretty. Danny said he did, although he didn't really care for the mountains, one way or the other. As Ullman was closing the door behind them, Danny looked back over his shoulder. The bloodstain had returned, only now it was fresh. It was running. Ullman, looking directly at it, went on with his running commentary about the famous men who had stayed here. Danny discovered that he had bitten his lip hard enough to make it bleed, and he had never even felt it. As they walked on down the corridor, he fell a little bit behind the others and wiped the blood away with the back of his hand, and thought about blood. Did Mr. Halloran see blood, or was it something worse? I don't think those things can hurt you. There was an iron scream behind his lips, but he would not let it out. His mommy and daddy could not see such things. They never had. He would keep quiet. His mommy and daddy were loving each other, and that was a real thing. The other things were just like pictures in a book. Some pictures were scary, but they couldn't hurt you. They couldn't hurt you. Mr. Ullman showed them some other rooms on the third floor, leading them through corridors that twisted and turned like a maze. They were all sweets up here, Mr. Ullman said, although Danny didn't see any candy. He showed them some rooms where a lady named Marilyn Monroe once stayed, when she was married to a man named Arthur Miller. Danny got a vague understanding that Marilyn and Arthur had gotten a divorce not long after they were in the Overlook Hotel.
Mommy? What, honey?
If they were married, why did they have different names? You and Daddy have the same names.
Yes, but we're not famous, Danny, Jack said. Famous women keep their same names even after they get married because their names are their bread and butter.
Bread and butter, Danny said, completely mystified.
What Daddy means is that people used to like to go to the movies and see Marilyn Monroe, Wendy said, but they might not like to go to see Marilyn Miller.
Why not? She'd still be the same lady. Wouldn't everyone know that?
Yes, but...
She looked at Jack helplessly.
Truman Capote once stayed in this room, Ullman interrupted impatiently. He opened the door. That was in my time. An awfully nice man. Continental manners.
There was nothing remarkable in any of these rooms, except for the absence of suites, which Mr. Ullman kept calling them, nothing that Danny was afraid of. In fact, there was only one other thing on the third floor that bothered Danny, and he could not have said why. It was the fire extinguisher on the wall, just before they turned the corner and went back to the elevator, which stood open and waiting like a mouthful of gold teeth. It was an old-fashioned extinguisher, a flat hose folded back a dozen times upon itself, one end attached to a large red valve, the other ending in a brass nozzle. The folds of the hose were secured with a red steel slat on a hinge. In case of a fire, you could knock the steel slat up and out of the way with one hard push, and the hose was yours. Danny could see that much. He was good at seeing how things worked. By the time he was 2 and a half, he had been unlocking the protective gate his father had installed at the top of the stairs in the Stovington house. He had seen how the lock worked. His daddy said it was a knack. Some people had the knack, and some people didn't. This fire extinguisher was a little older than others he had seen, the one in the nursery school, for instance, but that was not so unusual. Nonetheless, it filled him with faint unease, curled up there against the light blue wallpaper like a sleeping snake, and he was glad when it was out of sight around the corner.
"Of course all the windows have to be shuttered," Mr. Ullman said as they stepped back into the elevator. Once again the car sank queasily beneath their feet. "But I'm particularly concerned about the one in the presidential suite. The original bill on that window was $420, and that was over 30 years ago. It would cost 8 times that to replace today."
"I'll shutter it," Jack said. They went down to the second floor, where there were more rooms and even more twists and turns in the corridor. The light from the windows had begun to fade appreciably now as the sun went behind the mountains. Mr. Ullman showed them one or two rooms, and that was all. He walked past 217, the one Dick Halloran had warned him about, without slowing. Danny looked at the bland number plate on the door with uneasy fascination. Then down to the first floor. Mr. Ullman didn't show them into any rooms here until they had almost reached the thickly carpeted staircase that led down into the lobby again.
"Here are your quarters," he said. "I think you'll find them adequate."
They went in. Danny was braced for whatever might be there. There was nothing. Wendy Torrance felt a strong surge of relief. The presidential suite, with its cold elegance, had made her feel awkward and clumsy. It was all very well to visit some restored historical building with a bedroom plaque that announced Abraham Lincoln or Franklin D. Roosevelt had slept there, but another thing entirely to imagine you and your husband lying beneath acreages of linen and perhaps making love where the greatest men in the world had once lain. The most powerful, anyway, she amended. But this apartment was simpler, homier, almost inviting. She thought she could abide this place for a season with no great difficulty.
"It's very pleasant," she said to Ullman, and heard the gratitude in her voice.
Ullman nodded. "Simple, but adequate. During the season, this suite quarters the cook and his wife, or the cook and his apprentice."
"Mr. Halloran lived here?" Danny broke in.
Mr. Ullman inclined his head to Danny condescendingly.
"Quite so. He and Mr. Nevers."
He turned back to Jack and Wendy.
"This is the sitting room."
There were several chairs that looked comfortable but not expensive, a coffee table that had once been expensive but now had a long chip gone from the side, two bookcases, stuffed full of Reader's Digest condensed books and Detective Book Club trilogies from the 40s, Wendy saw with some amusement, and an anonymous hotel TV that looked much less elegant than the buffed wood consoles in the rooms. No kitchen, of course, Ullman said, but there is a dumbwaiter. This apartment is directly over the kitchen. He slid aside a square of paneling and disclosed a wide, square tray. He gave it a push and it disappeared, trailing rope behind it. It's a secret passage, Danny said excitedly to his mother, momentarily forgetting all fears in favor of that intoxicating shaft behind the wall. Just like in Abbott and Costello Meet the Monsters. Mr. Ullman frowned, but Wendy smiled indulgently. Danny ran over to the dumbwaiter and peered down the shaft. This way, please. He opened the door on the far side of the living room. It gave on the bedroom, which was spacious and airy. There were twin beds. Wendy looked at her husband, smiled, shrugged. No problem, Jack said. We'll push them together. Mr. Ullman looked over his shoulder, honestly puzzled. Beg pardon? The beds, Jack said pleasantly. We can push them together. Oh, quite, Ullman said, momentarily confused. Then his face cleared and a red flush began to creep up from the collar of his shirt. Whatever you like. He led them back into the sitting room, where a second door opened on a second bedroom, this one equipped with bunk beds. A radiator clanked in one corner, and the rug on the floor was a hideous embroidery of western sage and cactus. Danny had already fallen in love with it, Wendy saw. The walls of this smaller room were paneled in real pine. Think you can stand it in here, Doc? Jack asked. Sure I can. I'm going to sleep in the top bunk, okay? If that's what you want. I like the rug, too. Mr. Ullman, why don't you have all the rugs like that? Mr. Ullman looked for a moment as if he had sunk his teeth into a lemon. Then he smiled and patted Danny's head. Those are your quarters, he said, except for the bath, which opens off the main bedroom. It's not a huge apartment, but of course you'll have the rest of the hotel spread out in. The lobby fireplace is in good working order, or so Watson tells me, and you must feel free to eat in the dining room, if the spirit moves you to do so. He spoke in the tone of a man conferring a great favor. All right, Jack said. Shall we go down? Mr. Ullman asked. Fine, Wendy said. They went downstairs in the elevator, and now the lobby was wholly deserted except for Watson, who was leaning against the main doors in a rawhide jacket, a toothpick between his lips. I would have thought you'd be miles from here by now, Mr. Ullman said, his voice slightly chill. Just stuck around to remind Mr. Torrance here about the boiler, Watson said, straightening up. Keep your good weather eye on her, fella, and she'll be fine. Knock the press down a couple of times a day. She creeps. She creeps, Danny thought, and the words echoed down a long and silent corridor in his mind, a corridor lined with mirrors where people seldom looked. I will, his daddy said. You'll be fine, Watson said, and offered Jack his hand. Jack shook it. Watson turned to Wendy and inclined his head. Ma'am, he said. I'm pleased, Wendy said, and thought it would sound absurd. It didn't. She had come out here from New England, where she had spent her life, and it seemed to her that in a few short sentences this man Watson, with his fluffy fringe of hair, had epitomized what the West was supposed to be all about, and never mind the lecherous wink earlier. Young Master Torrance, Watson said gravely and put out his hand. Danny, who had known all about handshaking for almost a year now, put his own hand out gingerly and felt it swallowed up. You take good care of him, Dan. Yes, sir. Watson let go of Danny's hand and straightened up fully. He looked at Ullman. Until next year, I guess, he said, and held his hand out. Ullman touched it bloodlessly. His pinky ring caught the lobby's electric lights in a baleful sort of wink. May 12th, Watson, he said. Not a day earlier or later. Yes, sir, Watson said, and Jack could almost read the codicil in Watson's mind. You fucking little faggot. Have a good winter, Mr. Ullman. Oh, I doubt it, Ullman said remotely. Watson opened one of the two big main doors. The wind whined louder and began to flutter the collar of his jacket. You folks take care now, he said. It was Danny who answered. Yes, sir, we will. Watson, whose not-so-distant ancestor had owned this place, slipped humbly through the door.
It closed behind him, muffling the wind. Together they watched him clop down the porch's broad front steps in his battered black cowboy boots. Brittle yellow aspen leaves tumbled around his heels as he crossed the lot to his International Harvester pickup and climbed in. Blue smoke jetted from the rusted exhaust pipe as he started it up. The spell of silence held among them as he backed, then pulled out of the parking lot. His truck disappeared over the brow of the hill and then reappeared, smaller, on the main road, heading west. For a moment, Danny felt more lonely than he ever had in his life. 13. The Front Porch. The Torrance family stood together on the long front porch of the Overlook Hotel as if posing for a family portrait, Danny in the middle, zippered into last year's fall jacket, which was now too small and starting to come out at the elbow, Wendy behind him, with one hand on his shoulder, and Jack to his left, his own hand resting lightly on his son's head. Mr. Ullman was a step below them, buttoned into an expensive-looking brown mohair overcoat. The sun was entirely behind the mountains now, edging them with gold fire, making the shadows around things look long and purple. The only three vehicles left in the parking lots were the hotel truck, Ullman's Lincoln Continental, and the battered Torrance VW.
"You've got your keys, then?"
Ullman said to Jack.
"And you understand fully about the furnace and the boiler?"
Jack nodded, feeling some real sympathy for Ullman. Everything was done for the season. The ball of string was neatly wrapped up until next May 12th, not a day earlier or later. And Ullman, who was responsible for all of it, and who referred to the hotel in the unmistakable tones of infatuation, could not help looking for loose ends.
"I think everything is well in hand," Jack said. "Good. I'll be in touch."
But he still lingered for a moment, as if waiting for the wind to take a hand and perhaps gust him down to his car. He sighed.
"All right. Have a good winter, Mr. Torrance, Mrs. Torrance."
"You too, Danny."
"Thank you, sir," Danny said. "I hope you do too."
"I doubt it," Ullman repeated, and he sounded sad.
"The place in Florida is a dump, if the out-and-out truth is to be spoken.
Busy work. The Overlook is my real job.
Take good care of it for me, Mr. Torrance."
"I think it will be here when you get back next spring," Jack said, and a thought flashed through Danny's mind. "But will we?" And was gone.
"Of course. Of course it will."
Ullman looked out toward the playground where the hedge animals were clattering in the wind. Then he nodded once more in a businesslike way.
"Goodbye, then."
He walked quickly and prissily across to his car, a ridiculously big one for such a little man, and tucked himself into it. The Lincoln's motor purred into life, and the taillights flashed as he pulled out of his parking stall. As the car moved away, Jack could read the small sign at the head of the stall, "Reserved for Mr. Ullman, Manager."
"Right,"
Jack said softly. They watched until the car was out of sight, headed down the eastern slope. When it was gone, the three of them looked at each other for a silent, almost frightened moment. They were alone. Aspen leaves whirled and skittered in aimless packs across the lawn that was now neatly mowed and tended for no guest's eyes. There was no one to see the autumn leaves steal across the grass but the three of them. It gave Jack a curious, shrinking feeling, as if his life force had dwindled to a mere spark while the hotel and the grounds had suddenly doubled in size and become sinister, dwarfing them with sullen, inanimate power. Then Wendy said, "Look at you, Doc. Your nose is running like a fire hose. Let's get inside." And they did, closing the door firmly behind them against the restless whine of the wind. Part 3. The Wasp's Nest. 14. Up on the Roof.
"Oh, you goddamn fucking son of a bitch!"
Jack Torrance cried these words out in both surprise and agony as he slapped his right hand against his blue chambray work shirt, dislodging the big, slow-moving wasp that had stung him. Then he was scrambling up the roof as fast as he could, looking back over his shoulder to see if the wasp's brothers and sisters were rising from the nest he had uncovered to do battle. If they were, it could be bad. The nest was between him and his ladder, and the trapdoor leading down into the attic was locked from the inside. The drop was 70 feet from the roof to the cement patio between the hotel and the lawn. The clear air above the nest was still and undisturbed. Jack whistled disgustedly between his teeth, sat straddling the peak of the roof, and examined his right index finger. It was swelling already, and he supposed he would have to try and creep past that nest to his ladder so he could go down and put some ice on it. It was October 20th. Wendy and Danny had gone down to Sidewinder in the hotel truck, an elderly, rattling Dodge that was still more trustworthy than the VW, which was now wheezing gravely and seemed terminal, to get 3 gallons of milk and do some Christmas shopping. It was early to shop, but there was no telling when the snow would come to stay. There had already been flurries, and in some places the road down from the overlook was slick with patch ice. So far the fall had been almost preternaturally beautiful. In the 3 weeks they had been here, golden day had followed golden day. Crisp 30-degree mornings gave way to afternoon temperatures in the low 60s, the perfect temperature for climbing around on the overlook's gently sloping western roof and doing the shingling. Jack had admitted freely to Wendy that he could have finished the job 4 days ago, but he felt no real urge to hurry. The view from up here was spectacular, even putting the vista from the presidential suite in the shade. More important, the work itself was soothing. On the roof, he felt himself healing from the troubled wounds of the last 3 years. On the roof, he felt at peace. Those 3 years began to seem like a turbulent nightmare. The shingles had been badly rotted, some of them blown entirely away by last winter's storms. He had ripped them all up, yelling, "Bombs away!" as he dropped them over the side, not wanting Danny to get hit in case he had wandered over. He had been pulling out bad flashing when the wasp had gotten him. The ironic part was that he warned himself each time he climbed onto the roof to keep an eye out for nests. He had gotten that bug bomb just in case. But this morning the stillness and peace had been so complete that his watchfulness had lapsed. He had been back in the world of the play he was slowly creating, roughing out whatever scene he would be working on that evening in his head. The play was going very well, and although Wendy had said little, he knew she was pleased. He had been roadblocked on the crucial scene between Denker, the sadistic headmaster, and Gary Benson, his young hero, during the last unhappy 6 months at Stovington, months when the craving for a drink had been so bad that he could barely concentrate on his in-class lectures, let alone his extracurricular literary ambitions. But in the last 12 evenings, as he actually sat down in front of the office model Underwood he had borrowed from the main office downstairs, the roadblock had disappeared under his fingers as magically as cotton candy dissolves on the lips. He had come up almost effortlessly with the insights into Denker's character that had always been lacking, and he had rewritten most of the second act accordingly, making it revolve around the new scene. And the progress of the third act, which he had been turning over in his mind when the wasp put an end to cogitation, was coming clearer all the time. He thought he could rough it out in 2 weeks, and have a clean copy of the whole damned play by New Year's. He had an agent in New York, a tough, red-headed woman named Phyllis Sandler, who smoked Herbert Terryton's, drank Jim Beam from a paper cup, and thought the literary sun rose and set on Sean O'Casey. She had marketed 3 of Jack's short stories, including the Esquire piece. He had written her about the play, which was called The Little School, describing the basic conflict between Denker, a gifted student who had failed into becoming the brutal and brutalizing headmaster of a turn-of-the-century New England prep school, and Gary Benson, the student he sees as a younger version of himself. Phyllis had written back expressing interest and admonishing him to read O'Casey before sitting down to it. She had written again earlier that year, asking where the hell was the play. He had written back wryly that the little school had been indefinitely and perhaps infinitely delayed between hand and page in that interesting intellectual goby known as the writer's block. Now it looked as if she might actually get the play. Whether or not it was any good or if it would ever see actual production was another matter, and he didn't seem to care a great deal about those things. He felt in a way that the play itself, the whole thing, was the roadblock, a colossal symbol of the bad years at Stovington Prep, the marriage he had almost totaled like a nutty kid behind the wheel of an old jalopy, the monstrous assault on his son, the incident in the parking lot with George Hatfield, an incident he could no longer view as just another sudden and destructive flare of temper. He now thought that part of his drinking problem had stemmed from an unconscious desire to be free of Stovington, and the security he felt was stifling whatever creative urge he had. He had stopped drinking, but the need to be free had been just as great, hence George Hatfield. Now all that remained of those days was the play on the desk in his and Wendy's bedroom, and when it was done and sent off to Phyllis's hole-in-the-wall New York agency, he could turn to other things. Not a novel. He was not ready to stumble into the swamp of another 3-year undertaking, but surely more short stories, perhaps a book of them. Moving warily, he scrambled back down the slope of the roof on his hands and knees, past the line of demarcation where the fresh green bird shingles gave way to the section of roof he had just finished clearing. He came to the edge on the left of the wasp's nest he had uncovered and moved gingerly toward it, ready to backtrack and bolt down his ladder to the ground if things looked too hot. He leaned over the section of pulled-out flashing and looked in. The nest was in there, tucked into the space between the old flashing and the final roof undercoating of 3x5s. It was a damn big one. The grayish paper ball looked to Jack as if it might be nearly 2 feet through the center. Its shape was not perfect because the space between the flashing and the boards was too narrow, but he thought the little buggers had still done a pretty respectable job. The surface of the nest was a crawl with the lumbering, slow-moving insects. They were the big mean ones, not yellow jackets, which are smaller and calmer, but wall wasps. They had been rendered sludgy and stupid by the fall temperatures, but Jack, who knew about wasps from his childhood, counted himself lucky that he had been stung only once. And he thought, if Ullman had hired the job done in the height of summer, the workman who tore up that particular section of the flashing would have gotten one hell of a surprise. Yes, indeedy. When a dozen wall wasps land on you all at once and start stinging your face and hands and arms, stinging your legs right through your pants, it would be entirely possible to forget you were 70 feet up. You might just charge right off the edge of the roof while you were trying to get away from them. All from those little things, the biggest of them only half the length of a pencil stub. He had read someplace, in a Sunday supplement piece or a back-of-the-book news magazine article, that 7% of all automobile fatalities go unexplained. No mechanical failure, no excessive speed, no booze, no bad weather. Simply one car crashes on deserted sections of road. One dead occupant, the driver, unable to explain what had happened to him. The article had included an interview with a state trooper who theorized that many of these so-called foo crashes resulted from insects in the car. Wasps, a bee, possibly even a spider or moth. The driver gets panicky, tries to swat it or unroll a window to let it out. Possibly the insect stings him. Maybe the driver just loses control. Either way, it's bang. All over. And the insect, usually completely unharmed, would buzz merrily out of the smoking wreck, looking for greener pastures. The trooper had been in favor of having pathologists look for insect venom while autopsying such victims, Jack recalled. Now, looking down into the nest, it seemed to him that it could serve as both a workable symbol for what he had been through and what he had dragged his hostages to fortune through, and an omen for a better future. How else could you explain the things that had happened to him? For he still felt that the whole range of unhappy Stovington experiences had to be looked at with Jack Torrance in the passive mode. He had not done things. Things had been done to him. He had known plenty of people on the Stovington faculty, two of them right in the English department, who were hard drinkers. Zack Tunney was in the habit of picking up a full keg of beer on Saturday afternoon, plonking it in a backyard snowbank overnight, and then killing damn near all of it on Sunday watching football games and old movies. Yet through the week, Zack was as sober as a judge. A weak cocktail with lunch was an occasion. He and Al Shockley had been alcoholics. They had sought each other out like two cast-offs who were still social enough to prefer drowning together to doing it alone. The sea had been whole grain instead of salt, that was all. Looking down at the wasps, as they slowly went about their instinctual business before winter closed down to kill all but their hibernating queen, he would go further. He was still an alcoholic, always would be, perhaps had been since sophomore class night in high school when he had taken his first drink. It had nothing to do with willpower, or the morality of drinking, or the weakness or strength of his own character. There was a broken switch somewhere inside, or a circuit breaker that didn't work, and he had been propelled down the chute willy-nilly, slowly at first, then accelerating as Stovington applied its pressures on him. A big, greased slide, and at the bottom had been a shattered, ownerless bicycle and a son with a broken arm. Jack Torrance in the passive mode. And his temper? Same thing. All his life he had been trying unsuccessfully to control it. He could remember himself at 7, spanked by a neighbor lady for playing with matches. He had gone out and hurled a rock at a passing car. His father had seen that, and he had descended on little Jackie, roaring. He had reddened Jack's behind, and then blacked his eye. And when his father had gone into the house, muttering, to see what was on television, Jack had come upon a stray dog and had kicked it into the gutter. There had been 2 dozen fights in grammar school, even more of them in high school, warranting 2 suspensions and uncounted detentions in spite of his good grades. Football had provided a partial safety valve, although he remembered perfectly well that he had spent almost every minute of every game in a state of high piss-off, taking every opposing block and tackle personally. He had been a fine player, making all-conference in his junior and senior years, and he knew perfectly well that he had his own bad temper to thank, or to blame. He had not enjoyed football. Every game was a grudge match. And yet, through it all, he hadn't felt like a son of a bitch. He hadn't felt mean. He had always regarded himself as Jack Torrance, a really nice guy who was just going to have to learn how to cope with his temper someday before it got him in trouble. The same way he was going to have to learn how to cope with his drinking. But he had been an emotional alcoholic just as surely as he had been a physical one. The two of them were no doubt tied together somewhere deep inside him, where you'd just as soon not look. But it didn't much matter to him if the root causes were interrelated or separate, sociological or psychological or physiological. He had had to deal with the results, the spankings, the beatings from his old man, the suspensions, with trying to explain the school clothes torn in playground brawls, and later the hangovers, the slowly dissolving glue of his marriage, the single bicycle wheel with its bent spokes pointing into the sky, Danny's broken arm, and George Hatfield, of course. He felt that he had unwittingly stuck his hand into the great wasp's nest of life. As an image, it stank. As a cameo of reality, he felt it was serviceable. He had stuck his hand through some rotted flashing in high summer, and that hand and his whole arm had been consumed in holy righteous fire, destroying conscious thought, making the concept of civilized behavior obsolete. Could you be expected to behave as a thinking human being when your hand was being impaled on red-hot darning needles? Could you be expected to live in the love of your nearest and dearest when the brown, furious cloud rose out of the hole in the fabric of things, the fabric you thought was so innocent, and arrowed straight at you? Could you be held responsible for your own actions as you ran crazily about on the sloping roof 70 feet above the ground, not knowing where you were going, not remembering that your panicky, stumbling feet could lead you crashing and blundering right over the rain gutter and down to your death on the concrete 70 feet below? Jack didn't think you could. When you unwittingly stuck your hand into the wasp's nest, you hadn't made a covenant with the devil to give up your civilized self with its trappings of love and respect and honor. It just happened to you. Passively, with no say, you ceased to be a creature of the mind and became a creature of the nerve endings. From college-educated man to wailing ape in 5 easy seconds. He thought about George Hatfield. Tall and shaggily blonde, George had been an almost insolently beautiful boy. In his tight-fitted jeans and Stovington sweatshirt with the sleeves carelessly pushed up to the elbows to disclose his tanned forearms, he had reminded Jack of a young Robert Redford, and he doubted that George had much trouble scoring, no more than that young football-playing devil Jack Torrance had 10 years earlier. He could say that he honestly didn't feel jealous of George or envy him his good looks. In fact, he had almost unconsciously begun to visualize George as the physical incarnation of his play hero, Gary Benson, the perfect foil for the dark, slumped, and aging Denker, who grew to hate Gary so much. But he, Jack Torrance, had never felt that way about George. If he had, he would have known it. He was quite sure of that. George had floated through his classes at Stovington. A soccer and baseball star, his academic program had been fairly undemanding, and he had been content with C's and an occasional B in history or botany. He was a fierce field contender, but a lackadaisical, amused sort of student in the classroom. Jack was familiar with the type, more from his own days as a high school and college student than from his teaching experience, which was at second hand. George Hatfield was a jock. He could be a calm, undemanding figure in the classroom, but when the right set of competitive stimuli was applied, like electrodes to the temples of Frankenstein's monster, Jack thought wryly. He could become a juggernaut. In January, George had tried out with 24 others for the debate team. He had been quite frank with Jack. His father was a corporation lawyer, and he wanted his son to follow in his footsteps. George, who felt no burning call to do anything else, was willing. His grades were not top-end, but this was, after all, only prep school, and it was still early times. If should-be came to must-be, his father could pull some strings. George's own athletic ability would open still other doors, but Brian Hatfield thought his son should get on the debate team. It was good practice, and it was something that law school admissions boards always looked for. So George went out for debate, and in late March, Jack cut him from the team. The late winter inter-squad debates had fired George Hatfield's competitive soul. He became a grimly determined debater, prepping his pro or con position fiercely. It didn't matter if the subject was legalization of marijuana, reinstating the death penalty, or the oil depletion allowance. George became conversant, and he was just jingoist enough to honestly not care which side he was on, a rare and valuable trait even in high-level debaters Jack knew. The souls of a true carpetbagger and a true debater were not far removed from each other. They were both passionately interested in the main chance. So far, so good. But George Hatfield stuttered. This was not a handicap that had even shown up in the classroom, where George was always cool and collected, whether he had done his homework or not, and certainly not on the Stovington playing fields, where talk was not a virtue, and they sometimes even threw you out of the game for too much discussion. When George got tightly wound up in a debate, the stutter would come out. The more eager he became, the worse it was. And when he felt he had an opponent dead in his sights, an intellectual sort of buck fever seemed to take place between his speech centers and his mouth, and he would freeze solid while the clock ran out. It was painful to watch.
So I think we have to say that the facts in the case Mr. Dorsky cites are rendered obsolete by the recent decision handed down in...
The buzzer would go off and George would whirl around to stare furiously at Jack, who sat beside it. George's face at those moments would be flushed, his notes crumpled spasmodically in one hand. Jack had held on to George long after he had cut most of the obvious flat tires, hoping George would work out. He remembered one late afternoon about a week before he had reluctantly dropped the axe. George had stayed after the others had filed out, and then had confronted Jack angrily.
"You set the timer ahead."
Jack looked up from the papers he was putting back into his briefcase. "George, what are you talking about?"
"I didn't get my whole 5 minutes. You set it ahead. I was watching the clock."
"The clock and the timer may keep slightly different times, George, but I never touched the dial on the damn thing. Scout's honor."
You did.
The belligerent, "I'm sticking up for my rights" way George was looking at him had sparked Jack's own temper. He had been off the sauce for 2 months, 2 months too long, and he was ragged. He made one last effort to hold himself in.
"I assure you I did not, George.
It's your stutter. Do you have any idea what causes it? You don't stutter in class."
I don't stutter.
"Lower your voice.
You want to get me. You don't want me on your goddamn team."
"Lower your voice," I said. "Let's discuss this rationally."
Fuck that.
"George, if you control your stutter, I'd be glad to have you. You're well-prepped for every practice, and you're good at the background stuff, which means you're rarely surprised. But all that doesn't mean much if you can't control that..."
I've never stuttered,
he cried out.
"It's you! If someone else had the debate team, I could..."
Jack's temper slipped another notch. "George, you're never going to make much of a lawyer, corporation or otherwise, if you can't control that. Law isn't like soccer. 2 hours of practice every night won't cut it. What are you going to do, stand up in front of a board meeting and say, 'Now, gentlemen, about this tort?'" He suddenly flushed, not with anger but with shame at his own cruelty. This was not a man in front of him, but a 17-year-old boy who was facing the first major defeat of his life, and maybe asking in the only way he could for Jack to help him find a way to cope with it. George gave him a final, furious glance, his lips twisting and bucking as the words bottled up behind them struggled to find their way out.
You set it ahead. You hate me
because you know. You know.
With an inarticulate cry, he had rushed out of the classroom, slamming the door hard enough to make the wire-reinforced glass rattle in its frame. Jack had stood there, feeling rather than hearing the echo of George's Adidas in the empty hall. Still in the grip of his temper and his shame at mocking George's stutter, his first thought had been a sick sort of exultation. For the first time in his life, George Hatfield had wanted something he could not have. For the first time, there was something wrong that all of Daddy's money could not fix. You couldn't bribe a speech center. You couldn't offer a tongue an extra 50 a week and a bonus at Christmas if it would agree to stop flapping like a record needle in a defective groove. Then the exultation was simply buried in shame, and he felt the way he had after he had broken Danny's arm. Dear God, I am not a son of a bitch, please. That sick happiness at George's retreat was more typical of Danker in the play than of Jack Torrance, the playwright. You hate me because you know. Because he knew what? What could he possibly know about George Hatfield that would make him hate him? That his whole future lay ahead of him? That he looked a little bit like Robert Redford, and all conversation among the girls stopped when he did a double gainer from the pool diving board? That he played soccer and baseball with a natural, unlearned grace? Ridiculous. Absolutely absurd. He envied George Hatfield nothing. If the truth was known, he felt worse about George's unfortunate stutter than George himself, because George really would have made an excellent debater. And if Jack had set the timer ahead, and of course he hadn't, it would have been because both he and the other members of the squad were embarrassed for George's struggle. They had agonized over it the way you agonize when the class night speaker forgets some of his lines. If he had set the timer ahead, it would have been just to put George out of his misery. But he hadn't set the timer ahead. He was quite sure of it. A week later he had cut him, and that time he had kept his temper. The shouts and the threats had all been on George's side. A week after that, he had gone out to the parking lot halfway through practice to get a pile of source books that he had left in the trunk of the VW, and there had been George, down on one knee with his long blonde hair swinging in his face, a hunting knife in one hand. He was sawing through the VW's right front tire. The back tires were already shredded, and the bug sat on the flats like a small, tired dog. Jack had seen red, and remembered very little of the encounter that followed. He remembered a thick growl that seemed to issue from his own throat. All right, George, if that's how you want it, just come here and take your medicine. He remembered George looking up, startled and fearful. He had said, Mr. Torrance, as if to explain how all this was just a mistake. The tires had been flat when he got there, and he was just cleaning dirt out of the front treads with the tip of this gutting knife he just happened to have with him, and Jack had waded in, his fists held up in front of him, and it seemed that he had been grinning, but he wasn't sure of that. The last thing he remembered was George holding up the knife and saying, You better not come any closer. And the next thing was Miss Strong, the French teacher, holding Jack's arms, crying, screaming, Stop it, Jack, stop it, you're going to kill him! He had blinked around stupidly. There was the hunting knife, glittering harmlessly on the parking lot asphalt 4 yards away. There was his Volkswagen. His poor old battered bug, veteran of many wild midnight drunken rides, sitting on 3 flat shoes. There was a new dent in the right front fender, he saw, and there was something in the middle of the dent that was either red paint or blood. For a moment he had been confused. His thoughts, Jesus Christ, Al, we hit him after all, of that other night. Then his eyes had shifted to George, George lying dazed and blinking on the asphalt. His debate group had come out and they were huddled together by the door, staring at George. There was blood on his face from a scalp laceration that looked minor, but there was also blood running out of one of George's ears, and that probably meant a concussion. When George tried to get up, Jack shook free of Miss Strong and went to him. George cringed. Jack put his hands on George's chest and pushed him back down. Lie still, he said. Don't try to move. He turned to Miss Strong, who was staring at them both with horror. Please go call the school doctor, Miss Strong, he told her. She turned and fled toward the office. He looked at his debate class then, looked them right in the eye because he was in charge again, fully himself. And when he was himself, there wasn't a nicer guy in the whole state of Vermont. Surely they knew that. You can go home now, he told them quietly. We'll meet again tomorrow.
But by the end of that week, six of his debaters had dropped out, two of them the class of the act. But of course it didn't matter much because he had been informed by then that he would be dropping out himself. Yet somehow he had stayed off the bottle, and he supposed that was something. And he had not hated George Hatfield. He was sure of that. He had not acted, but had been acted upon. You hate me because you know. But he had known nothing. Nothing. He would swear that before the throne of Almighty God, just as he would swear that he had set the timer ahead no more than a minute, and not out of hate, but out of pity. Two wasps were crawling sluggishly about on the roof beside the hole in the flashing. He watched them until they spread their aerodynamically unsound but strangely efficient wings and lumbered off into the October sunshine, perchance to sting someone else. God had seen fit to give them stingers, and Jack supposed they had to use them on somebody. How long had he been sitting there, looking at that hole with its unpleasant surprise down inside, raking over old coals? He looked at his watch. Almost half an hour. He let himself down to the edge of the roof, dropped one leg over and felt around until his foot found the top rung of the ladder just below the overhang. He would go down to the equipment shed where he had stored the bug bomb on a high shelf out of Danny's reach. He would get it, come back up, and then they would be the ones surprised. You could be stung, but you could also sting back. He believed that sincerely. 2 hours from now, the nest would be just so much chewed paper, and Danny could have it in his room if he wanted to. Jack had had one in his room when he was just a kid. It had always smelled faintly of wood smoke and gasoline. He could have it right by the head of his bed. It wouldn't hurt him. I'm getting better. The sound of his own voice, confident in the silent afternoon, reassured him, even though he hadn't meant to speak aloud. He was getting better. It was possible to graduate from passive to active, to take the thing that had once driven you nearly to madness as a neutral prize of no more than occasional academic interest. And if there was a place where the thing could be done, this was surely it. He went down the ladder to get the bug bomb. They would pay. They would pay for stinging him. 15. Down in the front yard. Jack had found a huge, white-painted wicker chair in the back of the equipment shed 2 weeks ago, and had dragged it around to the porch over Wendy's objections that it was really the ugliest thing she had ever seen in her whole life. He was sitting in it now, amusing himself with a copy of E.L. Doctorow's Welcome to Hard Times, when his wife and son rattled up the driveway in the hotel truck. Wendy parked it in the turnaround, raced the engine sportily, and then turned it off. The truck's single taillight died. The engine rumbled grumpily with post-ignition and finally stopped. Jack got out of his chair and ambled down to meet them.
"Hi, Dad,"
Danny called and raced up the hill. He had a box in one hand.
"Look what Mommy bought me."
Jack picked his son up, swung him around twice, and kissed him heartily on the mouth.
"Jack Torrance, the Eugene O'Neill of his generation, the American Shakespeare," Wendy said, smiling. "Fancy meeting you here so far up in the mountains."
"The common ruck became too much for me, dear lady," he said, and slipped his arms around her. They kissed. "How was your trip?"
"Very good. Danny complains that I keep jerking him, but I didn't stall the truck once, and—" "Oh, Jack, you finished it."
She was looking at the roof, and Danny followed her gaze. A faint frown touched his face as he looked at the wide swatch of fresh shingles atop the overlook's west wing, a lighter green than the rest of the roof. Then he looked down at the box in his hand, and his face cleared again. At night, the pictures Tony had showed him came back to haunt in all their original clarity, but in sunny daylight they were easier to disregard.
"Look, Daddy, look!"
Jack took the box from his son. It was a model car, one of the Big Daddy Roth caricatures that Danny had expressed an admiration for in the past. This one was the violent violet Volkswagen, and the picture on the box showed a huge purple VW with long 59 Cadillac Coupe de Ville taillights burning up a dirt track. The VW had a sunroof, and poking up through it, clawed hands on the wheel down below, was a gigantic, warty monster with popping bloodshot eyes, a maniacal grin, and a gigantic English racing cap turned around backward. Wendy was smiling at him, and Jack winked at her.
"That's what I like about you, Doc," Jack said, handing the box back. Your taste runs to the quiet, the sober, the introspective. You are definitely the child of my loins. Mommy said you'd help me put it together as soon as I could read all of the first Dick and Jane.
That ought to be by the end of the week, Jack said. What else have you got in that fine-looking truck, ma'am?
Uh-uh. She grabbed his arm and pulled him back. No peeking. Some of that stuff is for you. Danny and I will take it in. You can get the milk. It's on the floor of the cab.
That's all I am to you, Jack cried, clapping a hand to his forehead. Just a dray horse. A common beast of the field. Dray here, dray there, dray everywhere.
Just dray that milk right into the kitchen, mister.
It's too much, he cried,
and threw himself on the ground while Danny stood over him and giggled.
Get up, you ox, Wendy said, and prodded him with the toe of her sneaker.
See, he said to Danny. She called me an ox. You're a witness.
Witness, witness, Danny concurred gleefully, and broad-jumped his prone father.
Jack sat up. That reminds me, Chumley. I've got something for you, too, on the porch by my ashtray.
What is it?
Forgot. Go and see. Jack got up and the two of them stood together, watching Danny charge up the lawn and then take the steps to the porch two by two. He put an arm around Wendy's waist. You happy, babe? She looked up at him solemnly. This is the happiest I've been since we were married.
Is that the truth?
God's honest.
He squeezed her tightly. I love you.
She squeezed him back, touched. Those had never been cheap words with John Torrance. She could count the number of times he had said them to her, both before and after marriage, on both her hands.
I love you too.
Mommy! Mommy! Danny was on the porch now, shrill and excited.
Come and see! Wow, it's neat!
What is it? Wendy asked him as they walked up from the parking lot, hand in hand.
Forgot, Jack said.
Oh, you'll get yours, she said and elbowed him. See if you don't.
I was hoping I'd get it tonight, he remarked, and she laughed.
A moment later he asked, Is Danny happy, do you think?
You ought to know. You're the one who has a long talk with him every night before bed.
Well, that's usually about what he wants to be when he grows up, or if Santa Claus is really real. That's getting to be a big thing with him. I think his old buddy Scott let some pennies drop on that one.
No, he hasn't said much of anything about the Overlook to me.
Me either, she said. They were climbing the porch steps now.
But he's very quiet a lot of the time. And I think he's lost weight, Jack. I really do.
He's just getting tall. Danny's back was to them. He was examining something on the table by Jack's chair, but Wendy couldn't see what it was.
He's not eating as well, either. He used to be the original steam shovel. Remember last year?
They taper off, he said vaguely. I think I read that in Spock. He'll be using two forks again by the time he's 7. They had stopped on the top step.
He's pushing awfully hard on those readers, too, she said. I know he wants to learn how to please us.
To please you, she added reluctantly.
To please himself, most of all, Jack said. I haven't been pushing him on that at all. In fact, I do wish he wouldn't go quite so hard.
Would you think I was foolish if I made an appointment for him to have a physical? There's a GP in Sidewinder, a young man from what the checker in the market said.
You're a little nervous about the snow coming, aren't you?
She shrugged.
I suppose. If you think it's foolish.
I don't. In fact, you can make appointments for all three of us. We'll get our clean bills of health and then we can sleep easy at night.
I'll make the appointments this afternoon, she said.
Mom! Look, Mommy! He came running to her with a large gray thing in his hands, and for one comic, horrible moment, Wendy thought it was a brain. She saw what it really was, and recoiled instinctively. Jack put an arm around her.
It's all right. The tenants who didn't fly away have been shaken out. I used the bug bomb.
She looked at the large wasp's nest her son was holding, but would not touch it.
Are you sure it's safe?
Positive. I had one in my room when I was a kid. My dad gave it to me.
Want to put it in your room, Danny?
Yeah, right now. He turned around and raced through the double doors. They could hear his muffled running feet on the main stairs.
There were wasps up there, she said. Did you get stung?
Where's my purple heart? He asked, and displayed his finger. The swelling had already begun to go down, but she oohed over it satisfyingly and gave it a small, gentle kiss.
Did you pull the stinger out?
Wasps don't leave them in. That's bees. They have barbed stingers. Wasp stingers are smooth. That's what makes them so dangerous. They can sting again and again.
Jack, are you sure that's safe for him to have?
I followed the directions on the bomb.
The stuff is guaranteed to kill every single bug in 2 hours' time, and then dissipate with no residue.
I hate them, she said.
What, wasps?
Anything that stings, she said. Her hands went to her elbows and cupped them, her arms crossed